Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Hello, genies. Glad you found us. It's America's family history show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com, where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. Hope you've had a great week on the trail and have found some exciting information and memorabilia. I myself had some good fortune turning up what is called a petition for letters of administration. Hoo-wah. I hear you. I mean, I know. If you're just working out what you find on various census records, this might sound a little unique, and it is. It's a document people fill out when their recently deceased relative didn't leave a will and someone needs to become the administrator of their estate. That means all the heirs have to be listed in this petition before someone is selected by the court. In the case of the document I found, it covered three generations because my third great grandfather had died before my fourth great. So his kids, the grandchildren of the deceased, had to sign the record in the stead of their deceased dad. And since this has been a tough family to piece together, it's an exciting and important find. And that's why we've got Gordon Remington, a senior genealogist with ProGenealogist.com, a division of Ancestry.com. Gordon has a terrific book out on how to make your way through these amazing records that all fall under the category of probate. The hardest thing about making a record like this is you have to be dead first. We'll be talking to Gordon in about 8 minutes. It is time once again for your family histoire news from the pages of ExtremeGenes.com. We start with a story from the site of an excavation at the Nashville Zoo. Near the turnstiles, remains of nine individuals, almost certainly slaves, were exhumed from a long-forgotten cemetery. The bodies told researchers from Middle Tennessee State University much about when they lived and how they lived. Shannon Hodge, who was an archaeologist for the school, and her team of students determined that all of the dead were under 50 years of age at their passing. They were particularly tall for their time, standing between 5'8" and 6'1". Several of them had skull traits suggesting African ancestry. The bodies were well preserved, had been buried in clothing, and the team discovered beads, buttons, and other interesting artifacts. Their study determined that the people had been buried between the 1820s and about 1850. The remains have all been reburied, but in a different location nearby. Plans are now in the making for an exhibit to tell all that's known about the people who had been buried right on the fringes of the Nashville Zoo. Well, recently we told you about the discovery of some ridiculously rare footage of the inaugural parade of FDR in 1941, in color, no less, found in some home movies. Well, now the Library of Congress has announced that an old house in Massachusetts has yielded 4 minutes of footage of the final game of the 1924 World Series between the New York Giants and the Washington Senators. The place where the film was found was in no way climate controlled, and the hopes that it would somehow be viewable were practically nil. But when the Library of Congress looked it over, to their shock and delight, the images were in unbelievably good shape. In the film, you can see the fans race onto the field after the Senators record the final out for legendary Hall of Fame pitcher Walter Johnson. The library then hired a musician to write some era piano music and play it to fit the film, just as would have happened in movie theaters back in the 1920s. If you're a baseball fan as I am, you will be amazed at the clarity of the piece. You can watch the whole thing through the link to the Washington Post story on our website, ExtremeGenes.com. If you're a Mayflower descendant, or even if you're not, next time you make the trip to Plymouth Plantation, you've got to check out the Plymouth Bread Company, which just opened. They create bread the way it was done centuries ago using corn. And the corn actually comes from a grist mill now operating at Plymouth Plantation, near where the passengers of the Mayflower created Europe's first successful American settlement. Word is the taste is totally different, and I'm looking forward to trying it on my next trip to the Boston area. Read more about these stories now at extremejeans.com. And finally, BillionGraves.com is continuing to turn up the heat on Find a Grave, announcing several new features this past week. These include global mapping, so you can pinpoint where all your ancestors are buried wherever in the world, an enhanced virtual cemetery walkthrough, so you can see what is near and who is buried close to your ancestors' graves, and records notifications, so you can program the site to tell you when they found one of the graves of your ancestors. There are other new features as well. That's at BillionGraves.com. And coming up next, a guy we haven't had on the show in too long a time. He's nationally known among the nation's elite researchers. His name is Gordon Remington, and he'll be filling us in on some of the ins and outs of researching probate records, what they are and what information they might contain. Probably a whole lot more than you think. That's in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, and after much prying and digging and scheduling, I finally got my friend Gordon Remington to come back on the show. He's from progenealogist.com. He is a senior genealogist there. He is the author of New York State Probate Records, Genealogist Guide to Testate and Intestate Records. Gordon, welcome back finally.
Thank you very much, Scott. I'm glad to be here.
Where have you been? All over the place.
Working hard.
Yes, you have. And, you know, we're halfway through October this weekend, pretty much. And so I'm thinking October, Halloween. It's good to talk about what happens when you're dead, right? As far as the records are concerned. And recently I called Gordon because I was dealing with some of these questions, and I was asking about a thing called letters of administration. Everybody knows what wills are. But when it comes to probate records, there are a lot of other things involved, and that's where Gordon's kind of an expert in that. So he told me, hey, you've got to listen to me. You've got to get this petition for letters of administration. If somebody doesn't leave a will, right, Gordon?
That's right.
They may get a letter of administration for a member of the family to take care of what should normally be a fairly small estate, or maybe not necessarily, right?
Well, if they had property at all, then there might be a letter of administration if they did not take care of it in a will.
Okay. And so I ordered one of these from New York and wound up getting an interesting document back because it lists all the potential heirs to somebody that you would normally see in a will, and also three signatures of my ancestor on there, and I'd never seen this person's signature. So this was kind of an interesting thing. So I thought, let's get on and talk about what happens with dead people in October and probate records. So where would you start? I guess you got to start with wills, wouldn't you say, Gordon?
Yeah, wills are what everybody's familiar with, but they're not the only record.
Right.
A will is when somebody, in advance of their own death, decides to plan out what happens to his or her estate. And usually that means it's a person who has something they want to give away to their children or grandchildren or nieces and nephews. There's a wide variety of reasons to make a will. And a will is made sometimes well in advance of the death.
Sure.
And when the person dies, if they know where the written will is, they take it into court and they prove that the will was signed by the witnesses, would come into court and say, yes, I saw this man sign this will. This is the actual authentic will. And that's where the word probate comes from, because in Latin, to prove something is probatum or something like
probatum.
That. Probatum. Yeah, something like that.
Oh, that's
that.
Very good.
Yeah. And so a probate record refers to wills and not administrations, except in today's genealogical lingo, everything that has to do with an estate of a deceased person is filed under probate records in the catalogs and books and so forth, because it's easier to understand.
Sure, right.
And even Black's Law Dictionary, the most recent version of it, says probates have become known as understood to be any record of a deceased person's property.
What happens, by the way, if the witnesses are dead by the time the person who made the will dies?
That does happen. Usually they try to get witnesses who might be around for a while.
Right.
But the other thing is it's rare that you have a will made too much before the death. So usually the witnesses are around. I've seen cases where if the witnesses are deceased or moved away and they can't find the witnesses, which happens sometimes, there's some other special provision by which the will can be administered.
Now, let's talk about things other than wills. Okay, somebody dies, they don't leave a will, or a will is not proven.
Right.
What happens next for the family then? They need to get control of the property. Is this where the letters of administration come in?
That's correct, Scott. Typically what happens when somebody dies, whether they're testate, which means leaves a will, or intestate, which means doesn't leave a will, the first thing that's done when they come into court is to take an inventory of the estate. And in a lot of cases, the man's real property, or the person's real property, his landed property, is pretty well documented. But the inventory would also include all other things that belong to them.
Furniture, books.
Tools, livestock.
Right, also, stuff in the kitchen.
Yeah, oh yeah, anything that was of value. And they would appraise that, and that inventory would then have a value attached to it. And then from there, if the will specifies where the thing should go, that'll be distributed that way by the executor of the will, and that's the person who executes the will, or the administrator of the estate, that's the person that is charged with distributing the man's property.
Right, without a will.
Without a will. That's an administrator.
Right, yeah. And so that's where the letters of administration
that's
come in.
That's right. In order, okay. Yeah, there actually are two types of letters.
I hope you're keeping notes at home, people.
Yeah.
This is good stuff.
You will see letters testamentary, which are issued for a will. We don't often deal with that because we're more interested in getting to the will.
Right, right, right.
But letters of administration are issued to the person who's actually going to administer the estate. And then that person has to take out what's called an administrator's bond, saying that they pledge to faithfully administer the estate and make sure the man's property is disposed of properly. And they have to put up some money, so if they don't do that job, then they forfeit that bond.
So does every letter of administration document that we see include a bond record that should be available as well?
They're usually not combined. There should be a letters of administration and administration bonds. Sometimes you might find them on the same document, but usually they're separated.
And does the bond have anything of value to a genealogist or family history researcher?
It does, because like any bond that you would pledge before a court, if something happens to you, like you die, or if you don't faithfully execute the will, then there's somebody called a surety to the bond, which is basically someone who ensures that you will pay, and if you don't pay, that person will pay in your behalf. And usually it's somebody willing to take on the responsibility of making up for your either death by administrating the estate or paying the bond, or if you have failed to do it, then you forfeit the bond and that other person has to pay it.
Now, is that other person somehow tied to the deceased?
It's usually someone who knows the administrator well enough to put up the money. Now, most administrators are family members, a widow, an oldest son, some other relative. But I've seen cases where a man owed a lot of debts on his estate and the creditors become the administrators to make sure they get their cut.
Sure.
But when the administrator is related to the deceased, the surety to the bond which the administrator's put up may be put up by a close relative of that person, someone willing to say, yeah, this will be done. And they could all be ultimately related somehow.
Somehow. So that's a good record to get as well.
Yeah, and that's particularly important if the surety has a different surname than the administrator. It might be an in-law. A son-in-law, perhaps, or
right.
Something like that. Anytime in a genealogical record, you got to look for any names that could be important.
All right, we're talking about what happens when we're dead. Perfect October topic. With Gordon Remington, he is the author of New York State Probate Records. He's a senior genealogist at progenealogist.com. Gordon, let's talk about now the petition for letters of administration. Often the wills, of course, will already list all the family members. That's pretty straightforward. When they don't leave a will, it gets a little more difficult. And you gave me the advice, don't just look at the letter of administration. Look for the petition, because...
Well, the petition, and this is was originally New York State was the only one of the states that did this, but now you see them in other states in the union. The petition was to petition for an estate to be probated or administered. So you have them in both cases. And the purpose of the petition was to make sure that all the legal heirs to the decedent were named.
And notified?
Well, they weren't notified individually necessarily, but an advertisement in a newspaper was supposed to take care of that. The reason that the petition was presented both in an intestate and a testate matter, a will and not a will, is because sometimes a family member who should have been named in the will wasn't, and they object. And they had that opportunity to come and object, like a son might have cut out or something.
Right, or maybe somebody, dad was mad at him.
Yeah, and I've seen cases where a man didn't leave anything to the children from his first marriage because the second marriage wife had influenced him not to. And those cases do go to court.
Oh, boy.
And witnesses are produced, which are his gold mine, but that's usually not in the actual document. It's usually a court record that's associated with it. Now, and that's in a will where you do have people named, but if there's anybody left out of the will, they should be in the petition. For administrations, it's even better because administrations don't typically name every heir, the letter or the bond, but the petition will. Now, in New York State, those petitions started about 1830. And I know when my brother died in New York, I had to create a petition with the names of all his heirs, which would be his siblings.
Sure. So they still do that to this day.
In New York, they do, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of other states as well?
I've seen it in Iowa. I've seen it in New Jersey. Some of the states may not have adopted it till the later 20th century.
Is it every county as well in New York?
Yes, it is. In New York, they call the person in charge of estates the county surrogate, because technically the governor of New York is in charge of a probate of estates and administration of estates in New York, but he can't be in every county. So the county surrogate is the governor's representative in that county.
Ah, and that's what surrogate court means
then.
That's
right. And if you go to a surrogate's court, it's oftentimes housed in the same building as the other county offices, but you can see on the door of the surrogate's court, it'll have the seal of the state of New York and not the seal of that county.
So it's the extended power of the governor that operates
right. The
court.
That's right. And and fees charged by the surrogate's court, which in New York can be quite high, are set by state law. They can charge you up to $90 just to look up a file.
Wow.
And if you want certified copies of the pages, that's the difference. Certified copies are as much as $5 a page. If you don't need them certified, go for the lower amount, like 50 cents.
Well, and most family researchers don't need a certified copy of
anything.
Right. That's what's the point?
You know? That's usually used if you're actually going to court over an inheritance or something like that where you need that record.
And one other thought I had as I was working with this recent petition that I obtained, it had my great-grandmother's signature on it three different times. As
right.
I mentioned, I'd never seen one of her before.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, when she died, her son from her first marriage became her administrator. I've never been able to find him. He has a common name, mm-hmm. James Moore.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can find on that letter of administration petition his address, which I can now match among all the James Moores in the city directory, and a signature that I might be able to compare against a signature on a marriage document, I can now kind of get an idea of who I'm following here with a common name.
That's very correct, yeah.
All right. We're going to talk more with Gordon Remington about other probate records you may have never heard of. And I know there are many I haven't heard of, so I'm looking forward to hearing this coming up next when we return in 5 minutes on Extreme Genes, Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. Hey, welcome back to Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth with Gordon Remington. He is the author of New York State Probate Records, A Genealogist's Guide to Testate and Intestate Records. He's also a senior genealogist at ProGenealogist.com. And Gordon, just during the break here, you're telling me this story about a librarian you ran into. You got to tell this.
Well, as I mentioned in the first segment there, in New York State, the officer in charge of probate records in each county is called the county surrogate.
Right.
It's also called the surrogate in New Jersey and Ontario, Canada, for some, maybe because they neighbor New York.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I was in a library once, and someone was looking through the catalog, and they said, "What's this? What's surrogate records?" And the librarian didn't know, but had to say something.
Of course.
It was an aide, a volunteer. And she said, "Oh, those are records of surrogate mothers." And I just stood, I couldn't believe it. Because
did you explode?
No, I wanted to be able to keep coming to the library. But I just thought, right, surrogates records begin in 1830. I don't think they had the technology. In fact,
no.
They probably didn't need the technology.
Surrogate mother records, that's awesome. All right, so we've been talking about wills and then when wills are not left, and that's where you get an administrator to take care of your stuff. Is there ever a time where there's no probate record of somebody who dies? Under what circumstance?
If they had little or no property.
Okay.
That's basically it. I mean, you might often find an ancestor who's described as a laborer. Probably not, and especially in large urban areas.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, this isn't peculiar to New York State, but if you have an ancestor who was a farmer and owned real property, if that person did not leave a will, there will usually be an administration because the heirs can't sell the property until there's administration.
Right, until somebody has control.
Right, until they've actually figured out how much property there is and how they're going to divide it. And so the heirs would like to oftentimes sell it, but until that evaluation has been made, they can't go forward with the sale of the land. It's in limbo until a probate administration is granted.
Well, that's good. But if let's just say now there's no letter of administration, so you can't follow that. There's no petition then that goes with that.
Right.
There would be no inventory, I assume.
If there's nothing.
And there's no will, is there anything else that could be followed as far as probate goes?
Well, basically, when a person dies, either they have property, they don't. And if they left a will, that's a probate record. And if they have an administration, that's an intestate record.
Okay.
Now, there are other types of records that relate to a decedent, but usually one of those two elements has to be in place.
Okay.
For instance, guardian records.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Well, guardian records, a lot of people misunderstand the term genealogically because today we know that children who have lost their parents have to have a guardian, a legal guardian, to do certain things.
Sure.
In the old days, 19th century and before, a guardian was only named if there was real property or some substantial amount of property that had to be guarded on behalf of the child.
Okay.
Now, guardianships typically are found among the probate records. And what the interesting thing about guardianships is that the guardian, if it's not the widow or widower of the person who died, usually the widow.
Right.
It could be somebody else related. And there are two ways that guardianships were done. Under English common law, which a lot of the laws in this country were based initially, someone under the age of 14 had their guardian appointed for them by the court. Somebody over the age of 14 could come into the court and petition for a new guardian if they didn't like the one they had before.
Really?
And oftentimes, when children who are over 14 come into court, they're petitioning for somebody they like, maybe a favorite uncle rather than the uncle they got stuck with.
Right.
Sort of thing. So guardianship records are always very important because whoever the guardian usually has a close relationship to the child, some family member. And like the petition, guardians also had to fill out a bond. So you have a bond where they are issued letters of guardianship, and then there's a guardian's bond where, again, somebody has to be a surety, an insurer of that bond, in case the person getting the bond couldn't execute the guardianship. And that person also is usually a close relative.
So if you're going through this process, because I'm thinking of examples in my own mind. I found a guardian record of a third great-grandfather I looked for 30 years and finally got that breakthrough I'd been looking for, and it went way back. And it gave his birth date in there. It said last July, his previous birthday, he'd turned 19 on this date. So that gave me his birth date, in essence. His father died when he was 16, and his mother died when he was 18. Yet they still referred to these children as infants, which was interesting, an infant son.
Yeah, an infant child in an English common law was anyone under 21.
Right.
You know, anyone under 21.
Sure.
These bundles, these packets of records, are ones that are ultimately transcribed into a book, a guardianship book, a will book.
Right, they're typed up.
Book. Well, not necessarily typed up, but
or handwritten.
Now they are, but in the old days, there would be a copyist who would copy them in. So you always want to look, if you can, at an original piece of paper rather than what's put in the book, because scribes back then made mistakes just like we do today.
Sure. Yeah. Now, what are the minutes and orders?
Well, minutes and orders are basically the sitting of the probate court. They vary in different states as to what the court is called in each county. But that's the court where you initially go to present the petition for probate or for administration or to ask for a guardian. And the minutes and orders are basically the day-to-day business of a court, which says so-and-so came into court today and prayed for this guardian record or be named a guardian. And that's an issuance by the court then of the order for that to be done. So it's like a minute book, a day.
Is it valuable?
Oh, absolutely, because sometimes the loose papers don't survive. Loose papers don't survive as much as books do, the bound books.
Okay, so when does an inventory come into play? We talked about wills.
Right.
Is there always one in association with letters of administration?
If there's property that needs to be counted, yes. What usually happens is someone comes into court and presents the petition for administration or for a probate, and the first thing the court does is order an inventory to be taken. So that gives you an idea of when the person actually died. As I said earlier, someone could make a will, and it wouldn't be probated till maybe 5-10 years later.
Right.
But if you get the date of the inventory or the date of the order for an inventory, that's usually pretty close on the death.
Right. That would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. Now, going back to the surrogate's record, Scott, you mentioned the guardianship record. It gave an age at a certain date for one of your ancestors. Well, the petition for probate or administration is also supposed to list any minor children by their ages, and some of them do that age on a particular day thing. So what you do is you get a good list of the children, and their dates of birth, and sometimes where they're living at the time. That's one of the most valuable. And also all heirs are supposed to be where they're living at the time. In fact, I've seen petitions in New York where they're listing the heirs, and one of them said went west and was never heard from again.
Oh.
So he's supposed to read this newspaper back in New York and say, oh, I got to go back to New York from California to get my $2.
Well, he probably was listed in the ad, but probably didn't read it.
Probably didn't. Well, a guy in California prospecting isn't going to have access to a New York newspaper.
No, absolutely. Although he'd probably want it if he was prospecting.
One of the other things I want to mention about guardianship records, sometimes a child is left an inheritance by a grandparent. And the guardian is not the guardian of property for his own child because he is dead, but he's the guardian of the property that they receive from the grandparent. You see that often the case, especially when the grandparent is a paternal grandparent. And so the inheritance go to that child, that grandchild, and the father, who is not the son-in-law, becomes the guardian. It's just a way to protect the property.
Well, there's a lot of stuff to know about this, isn't there, Gordon?
Oh, yeah.
And that's why he's written the book, New York State Probate Records, A Genealogist's Guide to Testate and Intestate Records, Gordon Remington. He is a senior genealogist at progenealogist.com, actual researcher periodically for Who Do You Think You Are and others. And you just got a long list of stuff here.
I've been at this 35 years this month. By the way, you can get the book, New York State Probate Records, A Genealogist's Guide to Testate and Intestate Records, by going to AmericanAncestors.org, which is the website for the New England Historic Genealogical Society, which did publish the book.
All right. I hope people are taking notes. We'll make sure we let people know about it on our website, ExtremeGenes.com. Hey, thanks for sharing all this, and I hope you'll come back again in less than a year or two.
All right, Scott. Good to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
And coming up next, our preservation authority, Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He'll be answering another listener question and sharing some ideas with you on how to preserve your special memories and your records. Coming up next on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here with Tom Perry, our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com. Welcome back, Tommy.
Good to be back.
We did get an email from Aaron in Huntsville, Alabama, listening on WTKI, and he was asking about QR codes. I was wondering if you could actually make a tattoo of a QR code. Would that work?
Oh, absolutely. There's no reason it wouldn't. You could either do temporary tattoos, just QR codes, to have at amusement parks. In fact, I thought about that. Like when you go to Disneyland now, you have to buy a full pass, whether you're a little old lady that's not going to get on any rides. Because in the old days, you would buy E-tickets, A-tickets,
right,
different things like that. And so I thought what they ought to do is issue QR codes. And so if you have the QR code, there's a temporary tattoo, that gets you on all the rides you want to go. If you want to go in and just hang out with your grandkids, you don't have to pay $100 for a ticket, maybe $25, maybe $50, and then you just don't get the QR code temporary tattoo on your wrist.
Wow, what a great idea. You should work for Disney. Oh, wait a minute, you did.
I did.
At one time.
But back to the QR code, there's so many options you could do with this. If you had little children and they got lost in the park, all they have to do is scan the QR code. They know who they go to, who they belong to, and they can page you by name. You can put as much information on as you want. You could tell them what hotel you're staying in, as much detail. So if your kid wanders off, they go to one of the first aid stations, they scan the QR code. Oh, he belongs to so-and-so. They're staying at such and such a hotel. They could get the information out. They would have your cell phone number. They could call you and say, hey, you know, your two-year-old is at station XYZ.
You know, you keep coming up with these things. Are people doing this now, or is this something you could do with it?
Oh, this is something you could do. Nobody's doing it, but, you know, Disney needs to call me back and say, hey, show us how we can implement this. Could it be very simple to do, and it'd be awesome. I mean, if I had young kids, even if I have them on those little leashes, I would still want something like that. And leaving the park, if you have your QR code and you're not with the person that you're supposed to be, they could have security that you couldn't get out of the park. So if some little four-year-old was leaving with somebody that had tried to kidnap them, when they scan, the QR codes don't match up, so you don't get to take that kid outside the park.
You are always thinking, aren't you?
I try.
Absolutely. So hopefully that answers your question, Aaron, and thanks for sending that off to asktom@tmcplace.com. And whenever you do that, you get a $25 discount on any purchase you make from shop.tmcplace.com.
Exactly.
Tom, what else do you have for us today?
Okay, I've had a lot of people have questions about scanning, and just quickly, When we were at RootsTech a few weeks ago, we had people come and say, hey, I want to buy my own equipment. You know, what do I need to do? So I told the people that lived locally there back in Salt Lake where RootsTech was, there's a place called Picture Line, which is downtown Salt Lake, is a good resource to go. They also have an online presence. If you don't live in that area and you want to do everything online, there's a great company called bhphotovideo.com. B as in boy, H as in Harry, photovideo.com. And you can compare all kinds of scanners. If you want to get a good scanner, you're looking at least $1,500. These $200 ones at Office Max and stuff, I wouldn't get unless you don't really care about the stuff you're scanning. But if you want to get a real good prosumer, you want to spend about $5,000. Or if you want to get a Hasselblad FlexTech X5 scanner, they're only $25,000.
Oh, my gosh. It's a bargain at twice the price.
Exactly.
Well, and any time you get into something like that, I think for family history purposes, you want to share that cost with members of the family and spread it out.
And as we've talked before, if you want to rent one, we can rent you one. It's just as good so you can split it between your family. If you have enough that you want to send it around, you scan, send it to the next family, do that as well. But get a good one.
Tom, you've been telling me the last couple of weeks when we've been off the air about you got to get in these videos. You've got to get in your kids' videos from the 90s and the O's because they are deteriorating every day. Talk about this.
Oh, yeah. As we speak, while we're broadcasting right now, your tapes are dying. They're going away. The biggest problem with tapes or about anything that's magnetic, it's like the tire on your car. As you drive down the street, you don't actually see the wear, but after a while you see the wear. That's how tapes are. They wear out. We had a tape come in the other week from us. It's flaking. It's actually particles you can see inside the cassette. You can see little pieces of magnetic particles that are actually falling off the tape, which is generally caused by heat or poor storage.
And so when that happens, of course, there's really not a lot you can do.
Well, I've never tried baking one. One of these days when I get one in, if the customer is willing to let us try it, we're going to try it. Like we bake audio tapes and that fixes them, but I've never tried it with a videotape. So if somebody comes in with one that's flaking so bad we can't transfer it, we'll go ahead and do that. The problem with flaking tapes is those little flakes will get caught in the heads of your player and they'll plug them up. They won't be able to hear audio or video, and that's why you have to get the tape cleaners. We actually still sell cleaners for VHS machines.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Do they make them, or is this something you stored, or you find them on eBay or something? What?
Yeah, some of our distributors actually have them stacked away. In fact, we have one distributor that has old Betamax tapes still.
Oh.
Blank Betamax tapes. So if anybody wants them, I have a lead for them.
Well, it is amazing what's still out there, isn't it?
Oh, it's incredible.
One of the other problems you've talked about, Tom, is how people store their tapes and that there are different ways. Now, does this affect audio or video or both?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
It does them all. Yeah, anything that's magnetic is put on a polyester-type film, and anything can cause it to take off. When it's originally made, it's made through high heat. So if exposed to high heat, the metallic particles can come back off and they'll flake around. So the best thing to do is always make sure you store your tapes in a cool, clean environment. Keep them away from heat. Heat is really bad for them. The only thing that's worse than heat is water. We have some that go through floods, like we've talked about on the air when Katrina went through. We got a lot of tapes through there that had been in water and mud, and that's bad. We've had a tape that actually went through an oven that we were actually able to fix. But that got to such high degree, it actually helped the tape, or, you know, 110, 120 isn't going to do it any good. All it's going to do is hurt it.
So you want it to actually bake.
Yeah, you want it to actually bake. Yeah, make sure it goes through a fire. If the case itself starts melting, it's probably got to a high enough temperature that the tape inside is okay.
Okay, VHS tapes and then the big ones that we used to use back in the 80s. Are those fading away as well?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you play any kind of magnetic tape, even a mini DV tape, it's going to degrade over time. The nice thing about mini DV tape is they're digital, so we can still have a better chance of getting information off. But the way you want to always store your tapes, you want to store them on end. Don't store them flat, because a control track on most tapes is on the edge. And if one of the springs breaks inside and the tape falls down on itself, the first thing that's going to go is your control track, which basically is the brain of your entire tape.
And so there's no way for you to fix that.
Very rarely. We have some, we can run through a proc amp, we can run through deciphers, all kinds of different equipment. And sometimes they can bring them back and sometimes they can't. It depends what the damage is. So you want to be really, really careful with the way you store them. And one thing that is a misnomer that 90% of the people out there understand wrong is when you used to rent videotapes in the old day, it always said, be kind, rewind. They're not doing that or telling you that to make the tape better. They're doing it so the next person has it rewound. That is the worst way to store a tape.
Ooh.
Because when you rewind it, it rewinds really tight. So you want to always, when you're done playing it, take it out of your machine and store it that way because it's loosely wound that way. So don't be kind and rewind if you're trying to preserve your memories.
Ooh.
Great advice. Thanks so much, Tom Perry, our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com. And if you ever have a question for Tom, you can ask Tom at TMCPlace.com. That's it for this week. Talk to you again next week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.